Hey guys, today on the podcast, we have Eve Sturgis. She's recently remarried and she was a single mom, and she is a fantastic writer for Cosmo and a bunch of other sites. And she's got a website called magpielife.com. We talked to her about being a single parent, about identity changing once you are married again.
Yeah. It's a cool talk.
We talk about school counseling and the issues they're dealing with there.
And also we talk about oversharing, talking too much and oversharing and not saying enough sometimes. So let's dive right in. Hi.
Hello.
I feel like this podcast is all the many ways in which you can say hi.
Hi. I do that a lot.
I like that one, Serena.
Hi.
I like the one you said when we were yo.
Oh yeah. Oh my God. Hello, listeners.
Hello, everybody. You guys have written us such nice comments.
I know. I was just gonna jump into that.
iTunes.
This one made me feel so good. Okay, the title is My Version of a Mommy Group. As a working mama, I have a limited amount of time to spend with other moms, but this connection is something I crave. Listening to Atomic Moms makes me feel like I'm a part of an amazing mommy group. Ellie and Bianca lovingly share the ups and downs of mamahood in a fashion that most women wouldn't be comfortable or confident with. However, their honesty is needed and appreciated.
Aww.
And we didn't even pay her.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear. I mean, it is, you know, it's like we talked about on last week, at the end of last week's episode, you know, about sharing and oversharing. And I mean, it is hard. Like, you know, I'm a little bit more used to it because my husband is in radio and I got a crash course in.
I mean, he talks about everything.
Like
things that I won't even allude to on our podcast.
And it, you know, it's honestly really helped me because I remember when we were first dating, I was just like shocked, like, oh my God, people can't know this, you know, I can't, especially like being an actor and being out there. And then you just realize like, who cares? I mean, really, I understand like if somebody's feelings get hurt or whatever, that's a big deal. And there's relationships to protect and I get that. But like, you know, I mean, really, he always says like, if it's helpful to other people, then who am I to stand in the way of? But he's like,
oh, but that's interesting because I feel like my therapist would have a field day with him for saying that. Because if
really?
It helps other people, who am I to stand in the way? I'd say if it helps other people, that is wonderful. But one should also protect themselves.
But he doesn't care. That's the difference. He has no shame. He has no guilt. He has no that he always says like, I remember when we were first dating and I would tell him stories about like things that I had done that I was like a little bit shameful of, you know, in my mm-hmm. past. And I said to him at one point, I was like, it makes me feel so good. Like I've dated other guys that made me feel bad about things that I would tell them. Mm-hmm. And he's like, who am I to judge? I was a hardcore drug addict. Like who am I going to stand in judgment of, you know? And so I think for him, like he's gotten to the bottom, he's hit the bottom of the barrel and he's dealt with some really, really dark things. And I think he just doesn't care what anybody thinks anymore, you know?
I mean, I'm curious about the process of recovery and how much that allows people to sort of really just put it all out there. Because the other people I know that have been in recovery have definitely like shared everything with the world. Because they're sort of like, there's nothing to lose. Like, this is who I am. This is my truth. Like, I wonder what that process is that allows people to sort of unwind in that way.
Well, and I think you have to ask yourself too, like something that's important, you know, and doesn't necessarily say, like doesn't necessarily point to the fact that you should be telling things or not telling things right now. But it's just interesting to see the intention behind it.
Yes.
Is, you know, are you uncomfortable saying certain things because of other people that it implicates and you worry about your relationships, or are you uncomfortable about saying things because you're protecting it and it's something raw and tender that you don't want people to know about you? Mm. And in both cases, by the way, you are under no obligation to ever say anything. I mean, nobody is. I feel like everybody should be able to keep the things they want to keep to themselves and tell the things they want to tell. And for Mike, you know, and now subsequently me, I just don't care. Like, you know, there's things that I would have been really embarrassed to talk about earlier on in my career and in my life. And I just, there's something very freeing for me about being an open book. Somebody's at the door. We'll be right back. So there was this story that I shared on a blog that I had. Well, I still have the blog. I just don't write on it anymore. It's like once
a year. What's the name of the blog year. So people can look it up?
It's called The Space In Between, but I think it's still at my old, I don't know. I'll put
I
up,
think
I'll
the
put up
link is still on Twitter.
Yeah, the link is on my Twitter, in my Twitter bio. And actually, I've intended upon writing on it again. But so my mom did, she decided to do 365 walks, a walk every day, and blog about it. And then my sister did 365 runs. So she did a run every day and blogged about it. And so I decided to do 365 sits and blog about it. So and in the beginning I was really good about it. And then I just petered off at the end.
How many days did you get in, do you think?
I think I did all the sits that year. I just didn't blog about every single one.
Okay. And how long were the sits, by the way?
At that point, I think I was doing 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the afternoon.
Wow.
So it was very zen. And I enjoyed it, but I had a lot of time back then. I was newly divorced and searching for myself. And, you know, I like had all this time. But anyway, one of the blog posts I wrote about a very personal experience I had with a really bad drug trip out. And how it threw me into this whole anxiety, crazy depression thing for many years to come. And I had to actually drop out of college. And it was very, very personal. And I remember, like, before I hit send to put that up on the blog, I, like, had a little bit of a panic attack because I was like, is this too much to tell people? And the next day, it was like all of these comments of like, thank you for sharing your story. I just like, it's so similar to mine. And it's so nice to hear about somebody who's come out on the other end. And, you know, and I remember that at the time when I was going through my anxiety depression, I was like, I would read magazines to try and find just someone. I mean, also because I'm ancient and like there wasn't a lot of people blogging on the internet at that time in my life. So it wasn't like as easy to go find other forums or things like that. But yeah, so... You know, that's the openness, I think.
Well, I think that's what I loved so much about that commenter, that she said that. That
yeah.
She said that we talk about stuff that most women wouldn't be comfortable or confident with. I mean, I definitely read that and had a moment of like, oh, God, what are we saying that other people wouldn't be comfortable saying? And then I was like, yeah, go us. Like, that's awesome.
And I think that's the thing about being moms, too, though, is like you have this weird idea, and maybe social media is not helping it, where you feel like everyone else is getting it right and you're not, you know? It's like when we had our mom group, Ellie and I have this great mom group that just started a couple months ago. And the first night there, I was looking around at all the moms and I was like, oh man, like she's probably such a great mom and she probably has her shit together and she probably has this. And then we went around the circle and everyone told their problems. I was like, oh,
yeah,
we're all in it together. So I think like, you know, it's true. I think everyone's like really trying to make a big thing about how like with, you know, especially Instagram and stuff, is everyone's pictures look so pretty and perfect. And it's really easy to think that everyone's having such a good time of it. And we are. But we're also having a shit time of it, too, at the same time.
So I'm so excited about our guest today.
Yes.
Eve Sturges is this fantastic blogger seems like the wrong word. She's a writer, but you can find most of her things online. But for some reason, blogger doesn't – it's like not enough. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't have enough like weight to it.
Yeah.
Eve is a storyteller, and she really shares her own life, and she has no issues – with telling it the way it is.
Well, I thought for a second you were about to say no issues. I'm like, well, then we can't have her on this podcast.
No. I'll read her little bio real fast.
Yes, please.
Okay, so Eve lives in LA with her tweenage daughter and brand new super nice husband. With a master's degree in counseling psychology, Eve is working towards therapist licensure and is developing her own life coaching program inspired by her blog, The Magpie List. Her writing can be found at places like Rookie, Feminist, Trope, Magazine, and Clean Plates, and also Cosmopolitan. And she writes about being a single mom and about getting remarried now and like the identity shift with that, having a daughter growing up in LA. And she was really young when she got pregnant, and she shares it all. And it's so awesome to read. And I feel like she, like, whenever I read her work, it's like sneakily emotional for me because the way she writes, it seems like it's very, it's like, it's just out there. It's funny, but it never feels like she's trying too hard. It just seems like she's speaking honestly the from truth. Her gut.
Yeah.
And then it, like, at the end, there's always like this sneaky moment where I'm like, is that a tear like welling up in the corner of my eye? So we're going to take a quick break. And when we're back, we will have our special guest, Eve Sturgis. Welcome.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me, ladies.
Okay, wait, I just want to read the titles of a couple of your recent Cosmopolitan writings, okay? 15 things not to say to a single mom. 15 things you should know before dating a single mom. Those are two really great ones. We'll put up a bunch of your work. But the piece of writing that made me go, oh my God, we have to have Eve on, was your piece from February of this year called When Marrying Means Losing Your Identity as a Single Mother.
Oh.
And it's Everyone Loves an Underdog. So can we talk about that?
We can talk about whatever you want.
Let's jump in with that. I want to talk about the identity crisis of not being a single mom anymore now that you're remarried.
Yeah, it was really weird, and it took a long time for me to sort of wrap my head around what it was that I was feeling and being able to put words to it. Kind of, I think, and I write about this a lot, but sort of, I think a lot of us are always searching for the thing that makes us feel like we're unique, and not necessarily in a good way, but why we're the outsider, or why we don't fit in, or why something will never happen. And so for me, I think it was an easy card to play that I was a single mom. So whether it was things I could achieve because I was a single mom, or things I couldn't achieve because I was a single mom, that just became a really big part of who I was, and sort of imagining my life, I don't, like, as a movie. And, you know, and like,
don't we all?
Yeah.
Wait, this is a movie, right? Yes.
And maybe we live in LA, but imagining that I was, there was something special about being the Jennifer Lopez single mom in Made in Manhattan. I don't know where that came from. It made sense in my mind.
What I love is when you wrote, we faced life in Los Angeles as a superhero duo who ate boxed tomato soup from Trader Joe's and made special trips to McDonald's for ice cream sundaes with extra hot fudge. The trick is to ask them to put a pump of sauce in the bottom before the ice cream.
We actually just did that, and they didn't understand about the fudge at the bottom, and it was really devastating. She didn't know what fudge was. That was the problem. As I said, we'll get two hot fudge sundaes, and she, bless her heart, only understood them as chocolate, and it became a big ordeal.
And then you say, the truth is letting go of my single motherhood might mean that I have to admit and accept that my life is pretty wonderful and that I'm not the underdog anymore. Just as my life is moving in one direction, the lives of people around me are also changing. A number of our friends are divorcing and others are pregnant for the first time. Roles have flipped, and I'm trying not to feel guilty. See, people, this is really good stuff.
Yeah.
So was there?
I did write that. It's true.
Was there a moment when, in preparation for the wedding, where you realized, like, oh, I do need to give over more, like, weight or responsibility to my fiance? Where you were like, where that burden was lifted? Do you know, like, when I get a massage, or when I've gotten a massage in the past, they'll be like, give me your arm. No, give me your arm. And I'm like, I'm giving you my arm. And they're like, no, you're holding your arm up. Like, please release and give me your weight.
Oh, I'm still adjusting to that all the time, especially being pregnant now. And I was pregnant before with a partner, but we were very young. And
you were 24?
I was 22.
22.
And that isn't as so freakishly young to have a baby, but it's more about where I was in life.
To me,
in California, that's very young. Yeah. In metropolitan areas, it's very young. I was in college with absolutely no plans. So it was very young, and I was unmarried. And so to have a partner that wants to come to the hospital with me just for the checkups, just to, like, go to the doctor, is really wild. And he wants to make decisions with me. And there was a slight complication that has involved a lot of, like, medication discussions with doctors. And I kind of just don't want to do that. But he really like had opinions about it. And I was like, oh, you actually care. Oh, this is your child. Oh, okay. Yeah. So yeah, all around that kind of stuff. And then also just the ability to, he's very willing to hang out with my kid if I want to go do something and all of that.
I mean, he's a darling man.
He's really wonderful. Yeah, he's really, really wonderful. So yeah, it's always an adjustment still for me to do that.
And what was it like telling your daughter that you were, that she was going to have a younger sibling?
Pretty funny because
wait, how old is she?
She just turned 12.
Okay. Wow.
But she is like a real whippersnapper. And so backstory, her dad now lives on the East Coast and he was remarried and has had a daughter. So she has a little sister who's a baby, who's a year and a half, and they're now divorcing and he has a new girlfriend. So there's like a lot of stuff going on in that department. And she's still at an age when she still really worships him. So keeping that in mind, we were like, so, we have something to tell you. And she was like, you're pregnant. And yeah, and we were like, yeah. And she was like, oh, I've been through this before.
Aww.
And we were like, oh, okay. Well, I'm only, 6 weeks pregnant, so we don't want to tell my mom and dad yet, or we're not. She's like, I know. Look, let me guess. Next you're going to say you love me just the same.
Oh.
And we were like, oh, yeah.
And then because how many months after getting married did you tell her that you were having a child? Or like, because this has all been within like
a year
and a half,
yeah, it's been sort of like a transitional whirlwind. Yeah.
Yeah, that was, yeah. I experienced that in third grade with my stepmom and dad, like getting, they get married and then they had my little brother. And you're like, well, that's a lot at once.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got pregnant like within a week of the wedding. So it was like,
wham, bam.
Yeah. It was like, we got married in January and we're telling you in March.
And she gets along with your
husband. Oh my God, they're closer than, and oh, yeah.
That's
oh, yeah.
Awesome.
She likes him way more than me.
Really?
Yeah.
In a different way.
Yeah.
But yeah. But then we had all these complications with the pregnancy and it sort of became a iffy situation. And there was a day where like we were going to find out the sort of some of the final facts about it. And she went into dance class and she knew I was going to get the phone call while she was in dance class. Oh. And she went to dance class and I got the phone call. And then she came out and was like, did they call? And I was like, yeah, come on, let's get in the car and we'll call my husband at the same time. And because he was working on a show in Canada. So we'll FaceTime him. So we're on the FaceTime and I'm like, well, there's good news and there's bad news. And the good news is the baby's totally fine. Everything's great. The bad news is the baby is a boy. And she just totally night and day, just like so excited, has never had a boy. She's had a sister,
yeah. Right.
But she's never had a boy. And yeah. She has this one boy cousin and she feels like that makes her a professional at boys. And she's going to totally help me. And her and Kaylin know all about boys. That's my husband. And so it's been, ever since then, she's been really excited.
It's probably nice for her because she feels like she's still special because she's the girl.
Yeah. I'm sure that there's an element to that I just hadn't considered.
Oh.
With being an actress in Los Angeles as a single mama, like you moved to LA as a single by yourself,
mm-hmm.
as a mom,
mm-hmm.
following your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah. It's, yeah.
Because I'm curious about, were there people that were like, you need to like, because it feels to, I feel like it would be a difficult thing if you have a child by yourself, like the weight and responsibility of that. And then to come out here to like, how did you have the courage to do what you knew you should be doing instead of what other people might say, like, you need to stay closer to your parents, or I don't know.
Or even just the uncertainty of, right. I mean, I know for me, I moved here when I was, you know, 21 years old, and I was, could be selfish and be an asshole, and like, I, nobody depended on me. So you were doing this with someone who very much depended on you, and in a place that's not very kind, to single people, let alone people who have responsibilities.
Yeah. Yes, all of the above. So when I had my baby and was with her father, and for a very short time, and then ended up with my parents in Northern California. And then, and it was a kind of typical story. I worked at a restaurant in my small little hometown. We lived in the basement of my parents' house, which is a nice finished basement, but nonetheless, it's true. And I just, the feeling that this couldn't be the end of my story was just sort of burning inside me. That'd be the way I would describe it. And I just knew I couldn't stay there. And it's a beautiful small town, but there's not a lot there for you if you don't have a very specific profession. And most of those are like tech professions. We're near San Francisco. So I don't. And then the other, so that was sort of what was driving me. And then the things that made it possible were that I had no idea what I was getting myself into, which is, I write about that a lot. Like I just had no idea, but I knew I couldn't be there.
So how did you find your first apartment?
I Craigslist.
Okay.
I called.
So you were like, I'm going to Craigslist this.
Yeah. And I had some friends down here. So I like came and visited a few times with them and stayed with them. And someone told me like, oh, you would really like this neighborhood. So I just only Googled that neighborhood to look for places, or Craigslist, whatever. And so it's like, and then someone said, you could probably afford this much. And I didn't even sit down and figure out how much I could afford or how much I could make. I just was like, okay. So
was it hard for your parents to let
it was really hard.
Their grandbaby
go
down to LA?
Yeah, they were not happy. And people were very sort of cautiously supportive. I think nobody told me this is a really bad idea or do you have no idea what you're doing? But people were like, okay, well, this small town will always be here and your parents will always, you know, my parents were like, you can always come back. But I never went back. I just, and I've kind of scraped and scrappled and hustled and, but acting in itself never really came to fruition. And that has felt like an incredibly organic just development of my life. It's what drove me then. I think now, actually, 10 years later, I am so much more comfortable with myself. I'd be a better actress now than I ever would have been 10 years ago. But yeah, it turned into other things. It turned into writing and it turned into storytelling and it turned into some really crazy, weird YouTube experiences with people that I met. But I never participated in the traditional Los Angeles auditioning scene. And I know single parents that do it, and they I don't quite know how they do it, but for anybody that doesn't know, a lot of auditions happen in Santa Monica, and we live on the east side, and they would go and pull their kids out of school every single time they got an audition because driving that far, you know, goes past
the
school time, so
you can pick them up
and that kind of stuff. And I just was always like, no way. No way.
So what did you do at first when you first moved down here? What was your first job?
I worked at a restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had a friend who worked at a super high-end, flashy, fancy, famous restaurant. And they were opening like a new one. So she got me an interview and was like, just dress sexy. It'll be fine. And I got that job. And then,
did it feel like a dual life? Like, you're like, I have to dress sexy and be young. And then you're like, no, but I have a child that I'm responsible for.
It felt like a double life, but it didn't feel like a double life as much as when people just couldn't believe I had a daughter. Mm. Like, and I just didn't, it never occurred to me that that was weird or unusual or different. Mm-hmm. So I'd be, you know, we were all very young. And
I love in one of your writings, I sound like a stalker now, but you mentioned that when you got pregnant that you, and I'm paraphrasing this, so please correct me, but that you felt like disappointing your mother was not enough of a reason not to keep your baby.
Right.
And that what else did you say in that thing? I feel like it was really powerful.
Yeah. I mean, I was still young enough to be worried about my mom being mad at me.
I think that would have been the first thought I would have had.
Like, oh man, my mom is going to be so pissed. Yeah. And that was about as much thought as I gave to an abortion.
Right.
I was like, well, I guess that's not really a good enough reason for an abortion. My mom will get over it.
Can you talk about that for a minute? About the, because I'm clearly it wasn't planned, the pregnancy.
Correct.
And so what, I mean, I think it's just an interesting, you know, here we are on a show that talks a lot about trying to get pregnant and when's the right time. And you talk about getting pregnant when it's not necessarily the right time and what feelings you felt then at that time. I mean, it must have been a very scary, open kind of, you know, whatever that, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, no, it was actually not scary because I had no idea what I was doing. Just like that's a really common theme for me. Yeah. And I actually just wrote about that. A lot of people come to me with questions about pregnancy, about when they get pregnant, they're like, how did you know? And how did you decide? And these are all the things I'm struggling with. And I've also been used as an example. I've been held up as an example of like somebody that is pro-life or made a pro-life decision. And it just wasn't as simple. It wasn't as complex as that. It was much more simple than that. And I just sort of had this idea that if I got pregnant, I would have the baby. And because I was naive and optimistic, and I felt like that was maybe the righteous thing to do, although it wasn't a religious decision at all. And so it was scary. It was scary, but I don't know how to explain it very well, but it was so real. There wasn't and to me, the decision to just have the baby was so fast that I'm not sure that I felt much more about it.
Right.
In the sense of like, it's happening. So I just wasn't questioning around it. Like, well, I'm sorry that I'm not being real eloquent about it. But
I actually think you really hit on something, because I feel like certainly two very different scenarios. But I remember when my dad was very sick my whole life, and then he ended up actually falling and hitting his head, and that's how he died. And it was like this whole life of drama of his heart's going to give out, and all of a sudden it was like he got dizzy and fell because the medication he was on, and he went into a coma for 2 days, and that was the end. And I remember when I got the call, because we got calls all the time, you know, over the course of my life, like, he's in the hospital, we'll let you know what's going on. But when I got the call and it was like, you need to come here now, I knew like, oh, this is different than what has been before. And I remember standing in my kitchen and I can't remember who I was talking to, but I called somebody, it might've been my therapist. And I was like, this is so different than what I thought it would feel like. And she was like, what does it feel like? And I said, just nothing. It just doesn't feel like anything. Like, it's almost like it's so big that I just am thinking nothing about it. And I find that to be true for a lot of big moments in people's life. It's like you think that it's going to be, you know, imagine this horrific surprise or shock or being scared or whatever. But oftentimes it's like you're just in it. And I think your brain is just processing what comes at you at that moment, at that time, because what else is there to do? I mean, you've never been, this is a new landscape. So, I mean, I think it makes perfect sense what you were saying.
It's a reality that isn't changeable. Like, it's oxygen, or it's the color of my hair, or.
Yeah.
And you might have just also known that that was your truth. Like, that's what you knew, you were going to keep your daughter, you were going to be a mother. And so there was no wavering back and forth, because that was it.
Yeah. And I was really excited. I was really excited, beyond the sort of like immediate stressors. Mm-hmm. I was really excited, and adults that were older than me were very, very worried, and I know why. But and I had been behaving incredibly self-destructively and wildly leading up to that moment. So whether it was like a breaking point or a wake-up call, or it never felt as heavy as that, but it definitely was like that, where it's something's gonna happen.
It's a and total then, oh, game changer.
Here it is.
How has it been being pregnant again 12 years late, 13 years later?
Totally different, because I'm no longer as naive and optimistic about life. So not completely opposite anyway. I'm not, but it is heavier and more serious to just sort of know what it is gonna take and know. It's hard to explain again, but it's very different.
But that's
it's
so interesting.
Very, very different.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because before you were on your own. I mean, you were saying this time around, it's like someone who wants to go with you to the checkups and all of that stuff. And it's like, and yet the more of the responsibility and heaviness is there. And yet the situation itself is better.
Yeah. Totally.
So, you know, it's just life, isn't it? Yeah, it's like crazy. Nothing is ever what it seems. And we always find ways to kind of dink around and make it more complicated.
Oh yeah.
How about physically?
Well, I was sick the whole time with my first daughter. I was sick the whole pregnancy and just miserable. I hated being pregnant. And I hated it, and I was sick the whole time, and I was in like school full time and she was preterm. So she was 6 weeks early. So this time around, I was really sick for the first 3 months, and now it stopped. So that is weird and lovely. and I'm just older. I'm older and I can feel it. And I don't think that I could go to school full time now and do the things I was doing. And I have that sort of pregnant woman walk. And when I was 22, I was just a lot more spry. And right now I weigh more than I ever did with my first pregnancy. And I'm bigger than I ever was with my first pregnancy, but I'm only 5 months right now.
My gosh, Ethan, you were because you're not big right now. You were tiny with your daughter.
I was tiny, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. 22.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. That metabolism, man.
I know.
So now you are getting your master's.
I graduated. I finished. Don't have it.
Congratulations.
I have my master's.
You have your master's. And you are a master. And you are a counselor. Mm-hmm. What grades is it?
Well, I just finished up the school year, so I was doing elementary school and I was doing middle school.
Okay, what are the two biggest problems that you had to deal with?
Oh my God.
Let's say not from the school itself, right, but like children.
You don't want to talk about the California public school system?
yeah, that'll be its own
and
episode.
The resources that are available and not available.
Not available.
I would say with the elementary school kids, the biggest problem. Well, I should preface this by saying that both of the populations I was working with were in the very low income socioeconomic status of the world. And so resources available on all sides are less so. So the biggest problem were kids that in the elementary school, it was children who were not learning or behaving within the system, the way it's set up, because that's just maybe not going to be the best for them. So what they needed was a different kind of learning and a different kind of environment and a different kind of structure, but that is not available. So
where do they go?
They go to counseling with me, and they otherwise get reprimanded a lot for misbehaving and being, and they get labeled and they get sent to the principal. And so it's tough. It was not fun. It was not happy making. That's what I want to say. It was a sobering reality a lot more than. So that would be if I had a magic wand and I could change everything. And otherwise, kids just need to be seen. They just need to be seen and heard and talked to and appreciated and, you know, rewarded for the smallest achievements and acknowledged for their what they master, whatever that is.
Have you heard this organization called City Year? Do you know of them? Mm-mm. They do the. I only know because we got invited this year to go to a fundraiser for them through NBC, and they have counselors that sit in the schools and basically take on a smaller group of kids in the classroom and kind of help them and mentor them. And it was really, they showed like a video. It was really touching. I think a lot of times you go to some of those things and you're just like, it's, you know, this is the everyone's showing up and putting on happy faces. But this was one of those things that actually felt like, oh, wow, these people are really making a difference. And they were interviewing some of the kids that went through the system and how one guy that they highlighted, his mom, a kid, it was not a guy, he was, an 11-year-old child who was in school and just failing miserably, and his mom broke down in the teacher-parent conference and just said, I'm single and I don't know what to do. And this counselor decided he was going to make it his mission, and he just turned this kid around just by being there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, it's so heartbreaking because you think about the fact that, like, there are so many people that are just struggling to put food on the table for their families, and they can't be the parent that's, you know, earning and the parent that's there supporting their child. So these kids get totally neglected, and they expect them to be in a school system that's at least going to help them and support them in that way. And they're not. And it's sad, but it was very uplifting because it was really, these people are really making a difference. It was very cool. Very cool organization.
We need more of that.
Yeah.
And all, you know, and it's too bad that all of the schools can't or don't have access to all of them. Whether that means that they haven't contacted the school or the school hasn't reached out
for counselors.
Yeah. That every single school.
My sister-in-law.
3,000 more.
Hi, Haley. Shout out to my sister-in-law, Haley, who listens. She doesn't have a child yet, but she listens. And she's a counselor at an inner city Detroit school. And that is like, not to be religious, but it's the Lord's work, man. I mean, what you guys are doing is incredible.
Full disclosure, I probably won't be going back to the school system next year because it is so hard. It is so hard and so draining. So the people that can do it and sustain it are a whole,
like, different beast
breed of people that I admire. But I think that at this point in my life, I have to step back with the amount of energy it was draining for me, just emotionally, physically.
I can only imagine. And by the way, my husband and I were saying after that fundraiser, we were saying, like, I mean, there's a lot of organizations where you go and you see what they do, and it's good. And I'm not going to poo-poo upon anybody that's out there trying to make the world a better place through whatever form or means they see fit. But after this one, it was like, this is something that truly could change the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. You're taking kids that would just probably end up on the streets or worse.
Incarcerated.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, and I think that's kind of, it's one of, like, the keys, isn't it? It's like our kids coming through and not being able to even access their true potential because they're neglected and left behind, and, you know,
and no one listens to them, and no one knows, and they don't know how to access their feelings or how to deal with them appropriately. Yeah. I mean, that feels like, for my sister-in-law, a lot of the stuff she ends up doing is about, like, anger and, like, how to manage it. And, like, you know, she was making, it was so cute, she was making these, like, putting glitter in these bottles of water, and you shake it up.
We made those.
And it's, like, so cute and silly, but it's, like, because kids don't know how to – so what is the thing with that?
We did a thing where if you were feeling angry, you could shake it up, and then you had to take deep breaths for as long as it took for the glitter to settle.
Yeah. That's good. Wow. Maybe we should make those for moms.
Well, you know, it's a very similar thing to how they use to teach meditation to kids.
Mm-hmm. And the bubble blowing is a big thing too.
Oh,
they
have them
blow bubbles to learn how to just breathe.
Yeah. Because meditation, they'll say, like, they'll show a glass of water, and they'll say, this is the natural state of your brain. And then they put in dirt, and then they mix it all up, and they say, this is what happens when you get overwhelmed or your thoughts get too powerful. And what happens when we just sit the glass down and we let the water settle and the mud all falls to the bottom, and then the water is clean. And that is the most basic sense of, not basic sense, but basic informational way to teach what meditation is capable of doing. Yeah. It's, you know, we've been touring preschools, and it's really interesting because I, like, bawled through one of my preschool tours because it was so special, and it was such a special place. And I just, like, I thought I could, like, hide behind the other parents, and because I obviously was trying to be discreet because I felt really stupid that I was crying. And the woman who's, like, leading the tour goes, like, are you okay? And I was just like, and Michael hadn't even seen that I was crying. And I'm sorry. I'm a really emotional person, and it just is so touching to me. And later on, she came up to me and she said, you know, what was it about it? And I said, you know, I think it's just that I wish I had gone to a place like this when I was a kid. And by the way, I want to first say, like, I had a fantastic childhood, and I had the best school that could have been offered to me at that point. I was very, very fortunate in that way. But I think this is just the next level of understanding kids' needs and their need to create and play and be recognized and heard. And, you know, and I think we all want that. So kudos to you. And I totally get having to like step away, and maybe there'll be some other, you know, reincarnation of that for you later on down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be great of me.
Can we talk a little bit about Magpie Life?
Yeah, totally. Okay. Yeah, so Magpie Life is sort of my next adventure as I move away from being in school and working within the elementary and middle schools and working with young women as a counselor, because I also see an adult caseload at an office. So basically Magpie Life is it's designed around the idea that there are so many people in Los Angeles especially, and maybe that's not true, maybe it's just because I'm in Los Angeles so I get to see them, but who we get thrust into this sort of adult world, but we don't know how to be adults. So there's this whole population of people trying to figure it out, but don't know where to turn and don't have resources. And essentially that is the basis of it. It has a lot to do with being a counselor and having so many young adults come to me and their acting career isn't turning out to be the way that they had imagined, and they might be 30 one day, and that's really freaking them out. And men and women, and they don't know what to do, and they still depend on their parents, which is not a bad thing, but they have feelings around it, and just trying to explore with them what do they want to do, or what makes them happy, or what kind of person do they want to be. And I just get, I don't know. So Magpie Life is about trying to create an environment for people that gives them a little bit more of a context for figuring that stuff out.
And it's a group, right?
Yeah. So what I did in the fall was I created like an 8-week program, system, session, whatever you want, a workshop, where you could come to my house, and I had like a theme for every night, and a woman who had however much experience in whatever topic that was like a little more than maybe everybody else had would come and like talk about it for 45 minutes. And then there was just kind of a time to hang out. So the workshop was for women. I had a chef come and just talk about what do you eat and how do you shop and how do you cook? And she did a cooking lesson. I had this woman, Kelly McMullen of Wild Woman Wisdom, who's amazing. And she really believes in changing the world by educating women about their menstrual cycles. And you'd be amazed how many women have no idea what's going on inside their bodies physically, and then how that affects them energetically, how it affects them spiritually, how it might be affecting them, and what's going on with the moon and the ocean, if you want to get really deep into it.
Was it yesterday there was a new full moon or something? I don't know. I went to yoga. I just wanted to share with everyone I went to yoga. No, she said something about a full moon and that we should all be more restful, or who knows. But I got to look up this menstrual thing.
Well, I mean, we know what happens. Everyone in my family slept great last night. So
that's all it is. You're just supposed to sleep. I did some. So I did a self experiment in my 20s where I decided that in order to learn how to date, I needed to stop dating. So I did a year of total dating celibacy, and that turned into 3 years. And that was like a kind of a life changing experience. So I talked about that, and it's not about like, so now we all have to be celibate for a year, but it was just about how do you get to know yourself? How do you sift through all the complications of the young people dating?
I call it a man fast.
Yeah.
Or woman fast.
I did a woman fast, but I did a man fast. I didn't
lover fast.
I didn't do 3 years.
Did you really?
I did 3 months, and at literally, I know, that's as much as I can.
You had less
through.
Work to do.
3 months, baby, to
you
your
took
3 years.
Summer off.
I did. A season.
A season off.
In Ayurveda, yes. A season is what could be mm-hmm. necessary to actually make progress in one direction or another. So a season.
Well, it's often just about setting the intention.
100%. Yeah. And I met my husband literally
day 92.
Right after. Mm. Actually, I'd already met him, but we went out on our first date right after the man fast.
Because he was so aroused by the fact that like he couldn't have you during the man fest. It was like the ultimate, the game, right? Or whatever. Not the game. Whatever. What's the thing? You gotta like
man game, whatever.
Whatever.
The rules.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So
we talked about that, and we talked about also having goals and breaking them down into day by day things, a lot about just like, instead of this overwhelming idea that my life will be better when I'm famous, when I'm married, when it all changes, when I'm 30, when to just like, okay, but what is it that we can do today to get you closer to being the person you want to be? So okay. That's what we did. That's Magpie Life.
So,
and where does the name come from?
Magpies, the bird, are a few. There's a few things about the magpie bird, but they collect shiny things. Mm-hmm. And I guess people on the East Coast know this more, but so magpie, they love shiny things. They're known for collecting marbles and rings and earrings and tinfoil and ribbons, whatever they find when they're flying around. And their nests are made of these like beautiful treasures that they've made. And so I used to have a blog called Magpie List that was about collecting things that inspired you, whether it was a book or a movie or a music. And so it was called Magpie List. Like, what's your magpie made of? What is it that you go around collecting that's made you who you are today? And that was a lot about being in my 20s and being a single mom and feeling really uneducated and behind in things because everybody was talking about all this stuff. And I was like, oh my God, I haven't read anything in this many years and I don't even know what's cool anymore. So what is it for you? And people give me lists and I would try it out and then write about it.
Wow.
So then it was like, okay, well, how else can we expand this to make it, what else makes your life more fulfilling?
Right. You know, they say that, I don't know who they are, but they say this.
Mm-hmm. I know them.
Yes. That, you know, around the age of 5, whatever it is that you're really, really interested in, it will tend to relate to what you could potentially end up doing with your life. What would make you happy? That by around age 5 is the first 5 years, those things that you're really intermeshed in, which is interesting because my mom became a nurse. And around the age 3, 4, 5, she was taking care of all of her brothers and sisters because she was the oldest of 6 kids. I was putting on plays. I always put on plays and skits, and we would have like little performances at our house. So it's kind of interesting to think about.
I was always writing little stories and doing a lot of choreography, but not dancing currently. But I did. I think I shared once that I found my. I have my elementary school journal, and in 3rd grade, I said what I was going to do. And then the winter, I was going to live on a farm in a yellow house, and I was going to write children's stories and plays. And then the other season, I would go into the city, and I would put on the plays that I had written.
I love
and that's
that.
My
life.
Dream in 3rd grade. I love it.
I think
only because podcasting wasn't invented.
Yeah,
yet.
Exactly. Well,
neither had the internet.
I do think that we have a lot more clarity about who we are and what we want to do when we're younger. And then a lot of stuff gets piled up on top of that. And we kind of forget.
What did you want to be? Eve?
I don't know.
Did you like writing when you were younger?
Yeah, I always really liked writing, but I never thought being a writer, I think, wasn't flashy enough for me. I think I always. I came from a very like chaotic childhood, and I think I was looking for things that would get me seen.
Right.
So I think probably at 10 it was like I'll be a dancer and a singer or something. But I know I went through a firefighter, cop, postman phase. You know, like, I know I went through that.
Yeah. I wanted to be a vet.
Yeah, I think my daughter at one point wanted to be a vet or a hunter.
Amazing. That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing? She got the animal. Like, she loved animals. Yeah. Like, that's what she wanted.
Whether I help them or kill them.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, she clearly didn't understand the concept. But.
Well, and what do you find is your biggest challenge in, we actually asked this of a guest a couple podcasts. What do you find is your biggest challenge in being a parent? And staying true to yourself, especially now that you're pregnant again and embarking on a new journey.
That's so interesting because I was going to, before I understood what your question was going to be, I was going to say the biggest challenge is staying true to yourself as a parent.
There you go. Yeah. Why then? Why?
I think it's always a challenge to find the balance between what you want to do and what's best for everybody. And I do not have the secret formula for how that is at all.
Well, thank God.
Because yeah. We don't know the recipe, but But I do know that it's a challenge, and I also know that it often gets to be that we're all just doing the best we can, and I'm doing the best that we can, and tomorrow is a new day and we can try again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your honesty and your writing. We'll post those. They're really funny too. I love the single mom lists.
Oh, like, yeah, I want to read it.
Oh, God. And I'm like, I'm not a single mom, but I'm still relating. Which I also think, I feel like it's like not even true. Or I'm still laughing. But one of the things you mention is like that if you don't you dare say, like if your husband's out of town for the weekend, don't say that you can relate because it's not the same.
Yeah. Bless all the hearts of the women that have said that to me. Well, they mean well.
And also thank you just for all the rock star stuff you do and in terms of helping people and helping people find their way and their purpose. And I think like, you know, it does seem like big flashy change is very popular nowadays. And, you know, the things that can go viral. And, you know, I think we really tend to forget about how big of an impact it can be to just help somebody find out themselves and their path and where they want to go and what they want to do. So
we'll be right back.
We're back. All right, let's wrap this puppy up, huh?
Yes.
Do you want to do mom bomb or mom session first?
I will take a mom session.
Do it.
Okay. I found a really great t-shirt. I'm very excited about it. It's a graphic tee. And on it, it says naps every single day. And it's $28. I found it at Nordstrom's. But it's by Madison and Berkeley. But I love that, you know, we can all aspire.
putting the positivity out there. Yeah. Okay, you guys, for my mom bomb, I'm just going to do something fun because let's change it up a little bit. I have this great book called Live in Wonder, Quest Quotes and Questions to Jumpstart Your Journey. And a dear friend gave it to me. And so I'm going to flip and Ellie's going to say stop. And we're just going to read whatever that is for the mom bomb. Ready, set, go.
Stop.
What could you achieve in life if you decided to become totally and blissfully impervious to hostile criticism and rejection?
Say it again.
What could you achieve in life if you decided to become totally and blissfully impervious to hostile criticism and rejection? It's a good one for us, I feel like.
I love that.
Yeah. Good pick, Ellie.
I did well.
I'm proud of you.
Yeah, what's the name of that book again?
Live in Wonder, Quest, Quotes, and Questions to Jumpstart Your Journey by Eric Saperston. Or Saperston, however.
It's good. Good stuff.
Okay, guys. We love you lots.
Love you. Subscribe on iTunes. Leave reviews. Like us on Facebook. They should change that. They should be like, join us on Facebook. The stupid like thing is annoying to me.
Or even have options to do more like love, to obsess about us on Facebook.
Yeah. Mom obsess about us on Facebook. Okay, guys.
Trust in your goodness.
Live out your greatness.
Rock on, Atomic Moms.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, Schlesinger. I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.
A few days ago, Brooke Tudine posted an inspirational quote on her wall that got 17 likes and 3 comments. Thumbs up, Brooke. Geico also wants to make a comment. In just 15 minutes, you could save hundreds of dollars on your car insurance by switching to Geico. And nothing says inspiration better than saving money. Well, except for those posters that say things like teamwork, excellence, and make it happen. Hashtag keep climbing. Hashtag savings.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.